Apparently, all of you squeezed into this room. You might have noticed, so we are a little bit limited in our resources. According to Univis, so we said, okay, like we can deal with 20 participants. This is okay, so just for your orientation, so this is what 60 looks like. And 61. And, oh no, 4, 64. So, so good thing is 20 was outdated anyway, so that was last year's number. But the bad thing is 60 is a little bit too much, because we would like to have people really do the exercises and look with them over their results for the exercises and so on, and that's time intense. No? So what we thought is like, yeah, okay, so 30, 35, we can deal with this. So I guess we just have to see. I think I just have to talk to Mark Stamminger how we deal with this situation. A number of you sent me emails in advance to sort of enroll to the class. So that was much appreciated. Following the essentially what was written in Univis, and you're good, and I think we will try to find also solutions. But it's really a matter of, okay, like how many people can we allocate, how many computer rooms can we allocate, and so on. So no hard feelings, yeah. But it's, yeah, that is the situation. Okay. So I will talk to Mark Stamminger this week, and we will see. Yeah, okay. But I can certainly guarantee you, so anyone who did not show up today is not in. So we're not further expanding anything. Yeah, and we will try to find a solution such that you who are here today can actually do the class. Maybe we have to rethink a couple of things. Also, the examination, maybe it might be more appropriate then to go from it. So what we would do normally would be an oral exam, but it doesn't scale really well, because I have maybe 100 oral exams for pattern analysis, and then now 60 or so more wouldn't be. I mean, I can't do this. No, I'm sorry. So let me talk to Mark Stamminger, and next week we know a little bit more. Okay, let's proceed like this. But we will make a serious attempt to accommodate all of you. Okay, okay, good. In order to update my list of participants, can we maybe take one of your sheets here, and you, like, everyone enters his name, student ID, matriculation number, study program in that list. Just pass it through, and then if it makes the way through within these 1.5 hours, I think we're good. Yeah. Okay. Good. So this was already an organizational detail, but it's pretty important actually, because it keeps us operational. So what are the other conditions, things of this class? Okay, so apparently we're dealing with computer vision. Sorry, I forgot to introduce myself. My name is Christian Ries. I'm going to teach the first half of this class, and then Marek Stamminger takes over. And he will do the next half of this class. The exercises are organized by Amir Davari. And Darius, what was his last name? He's one of Mike's students. Rückert, Darius Rückert. Okay, it's a 5 ECTS class. That involves passing some form of exam for the lecture and successfully doing the exercises. The exercises are practical exercises, so programming some of, like implementing some of the methods that we talk about. And essentially presenting the results to Amir and Darius. So that was our plan up until yesterday. Like we will see how we maybe adjust this a little bit, like to deal with the group sizes. Okay. Talking about the exercises, so the lecture is always Mondays at 2. The exercises are, so Tuesdays 12 to 2, and on Mondays 4 to 6. And they are in the computer room, the so-called Hubertzip, the computer room that is in this small building between this building and the computer science tower. Okay. So before I start with some content or so, do you have some questions with respect to the organization? Sorry, exercises start next week. Yes? No, no, no. Actually, only one half exercise. So our plan was that we have blocks of 2 weeks. And you go to one of the 4 exercises that take place within 2 weeks. Yeah? And then you work, like there will be worksheets uploaded. You have 2 weeks time, plus minus these holidays and so on that always take place in the summer term. Yeah? You have 2 weeks time to work on these exercises, and then the next time you go there, you talk to whoever is there, Amir or Darius, show them your solution, and then it's good. Yeah? Okay. And I will try to get another student or something. Maybe we can scale this up to 60 people. It also gets crowded in the computer room. No, it's not fun anymore. No, so we have to see what we can do, but we will find a way. Okay. So these are the exercises. The implementation will be in C++, but it's not like super fancy C++ or so. It's just, essentially, if you as long as you are able to link to OpenCV your code, you're pretty much done. Yeah, so no template magic or anything. Yeah, it's just pretty straightforward, more or less imperative coding style. Okay. Yeah. So. So show your solution. Every second week, roughly. So we will post a timeline on the web page, yeah, such that you don't miss it. But let's calculate with every second week. So it's implementation. With C++ and OpenCV. And in the exercise next week, so exercises start next week. April, I think this is 15th or so. Let me check. 16th. April 16th. Where we have some introductory class or introductory exercise. To make sure everyone is able to link his or her code to OpenCV. Okay, yeah. Yes.
Do we have to pass every exercise or?
Yes, but it's gonna be just like four exercises or so. Yeah. So the question is, can we do the exercises on our, like, can you do it on your private computer, or should it run in the computer room of the university? I think it depends on who you ask. If you would ask me, I would say like the reference system is the university system. But Amir and Darius might have deviating opinions here, and then I would say, okay, it's their decision. No? We wanted to do groups of two, like, yeah. So why do we insist in the exercises? Because this is an applied subject. A lot of, or virtually all problems only show when looking at actual, like, real data. And like in the equations, so we always have a mathematical model, yeah? We will mostly do geometry, and we will see these models are super clean, yeah? So you write something down, no? It's an equation, hey, it works, okay, great, no? And we are done, yeah? And but it turns out that when dealing with real data, so real data is much less well-behaved. And then a lot of things just don't work, although they should work in theory or so. And then it requires a lot of patching. And actually, companies working in the field, they put a massive amount of resources in patching these little problems, no? Not the fundamental problems. So they are solved for a while already for a lot of topics in computer vision. No? But then they keep trying to make things more robust. No? And in that sense, I think it's just not possible to do a computer vision class without some like a reasonable amount of practical work. Yeah, it just wouldn't make any sense. Okay, so that's the rationale behind that. Okay. Anything else? Yeah.
Is it possible to offer another session?
To offer what?
Another session of exercise or shift it 2 hours before on Tuesday?
So you see, there are schedules for a lot of classes, no? And we also see where we can fit in, no? So theoretically, there might be such a possibility, no? But it might not be practical. So we think we prefer to keep it like this. Okay, anything else? Good. Then maybe I really quickly tell you about what my work is actually, or my relation to computer vision, and then we just start over and talk about the actual topic. So in case you looked me up in Univis, you might have noticed that I have two Univis entries. So one is with the pattern recognition lab. Sorry, my Wi-Fi keeps me waiting. So one of my Univis entries is with the pattern recognition lab. Another Univis entry is with the IT security infrastructures lab. My actual affiliation is with the IT security infrastructures lab since 1.5 years or so. But before that, I was with the pattern recognition lab. And my work actually is centered around things like aspects of image processing and imaging and image processing. And I'm still working with a couple of people at the pattern recognition lab. I think this lecture is also listed as a lecture of the pattern recognition lab or computer graphics. I don't know. So somewhere there, but it's certainly not a security lecture. I mean, apparently. I'm somewhere a little bit between the topics. Security wise, I'm in the field of image forensics, and that is what I did my PhD on. Image forensics is about telling whether an image has been manipulated or not. And so you could say it's an image processing or it's a signal processing topic, no? For example, the question, are two persons in the image, are they illuminated from the same direction? Yeah, so it's an inverse problem, if you like. No, you have an image, you try to infer the direction of the illuminant, or very low-level stuff like, has something been copied within the same image? Can you see this? Probably not so well. Anyways, then just listen, and it's gonna be okay. Also. Okay, so that is what I did my PhD on in 2012. And then in the past years, I worked in a field also with a work group that is completely different. It's called X-ray phase contrast, and it's more imaging. So about creating the images, building measurement devices, and then our computer science portion is to do some low-level image processing to correct for artifacts, like hardware-induced artifacts, because these are prototypical setups. So this is pretty far away from computer vision. It's really more signal processing. Okay, and then there are some other projects. Let me show to you Amir's project really quickly. I hope this is his webpage. Amir is working on multispectral image processing. So what is a multispectral image? It's like a color image, but with much more colors than three. And so you have a finer spectral resolution. That is what that means. And I mistyped it. And then you can use that to infer material specific descriptors and, for example, recognize specific objects. My PhD supervisor, Ellie Angelopoulou, she, for example, used multispectral images to detect human skin, because it turned out that the reflectance of human skin if you have the wavelength here of the incident light, if you look at the reflectance of human skin, this is the wavelength of the reflectance. It turns out that skin has a characteristic W shape in there, which you cannot resolve with a normal RGB camera. Yeah, but you can resolve it with a multispectral camera and then quite reliably find skin pixels. That is, for example, that was her application when she worked in that field. And Amir is applying it on historical documents. He's applying it on satellite imagery, things like that. There's Franziska I'm working with. She's working on image super resolution. So that means you have a sequence, like a video, for example, of low resolution, a sequence of low resolution images, for example, low resolution video. And then you're trying to compute out of that sequence one frame that has a considerably higher resolution, like four times higher resolution, something like this, without inventing too much stuff, no? Because you could always hallucinate images, yeah? But you want, of course, to be the solution to be as accurate or as much grounded in the actual measurements as possible. Yeah? So that is the task of super resolution. And before Franziska came, I worked together with this on Thomas Köhler. Maybe, no, that is Thomas Janu, I'm sorry. Thomas Köhler. So maybe some of you know him from the computer vision project. So he graduated last year or so. Okay, so this is the type of work I'm doing. And with Mark Stamminger, I'm working together on some image forensics topics. So that is how we are linked. And I have two PhD students at the IT security lab also working on image forensics. Okay, so this is my background. I never really did the theoretical aspects of computer vision. I worked with someone else together who graduated already, Peter Fürsattel. He worked on range images. That is probably the closest match to the geometric questions of computer vision. But I did a lot with the radiometric portion of computer vision. So thinking about colors and color distributions, things like that. So yeah. but we will come to this later. Nevertheless, geometry is an important part of computer vision, and it's probably the part of computer vision where computer vision is really stellar, like very rigorous in the math, no? Very clean. Strong results. And that is what is typically addressed then, or a key part of a computer vision lecture. And that will also be a key component of this lecture in this summer term. Good. Okay, let's do some actual stuff. I'm just going through that introduction, and we see how far we get. So these slides are not my slides. I adapted them a little bit But the core part of these slides is from a lecture at Brown University. Very nice slides, and they loosely follow the book by Richard Zelizky. Which is the recommended literature for this lecture. Yeah. What is the title? I think it's just computer vision. Let me Google for that. So it's available online. You don't need to buy it, but if you prefer a paper version, it's actually a really nice book. On the other hand, it depends on who you ask. So some people say it's an awful book. Oh, Computer Vision, Algorithms and Applications. Yeah, sorry, that's the full title. Computer Vision, Algorithms and Applications. And you will see there's actually a PDF is available on the web page, that like directly available, not from some shady server somewhere. That you can use if you like. Yeah. Okay. So some people say it's an awful book, and these people are probably come from a slightly different direction or so, because there's a second book or even a third or so. But let me just talk about the second book. This is by Hartley and Sisserman. Not sure. Maybe there's another N. We can Google for that again. It's called Multi-View Geometry. And it's really an excellent, excellent book. If you have any doubts about perspective projections in any weird space with any amount of viewers and stuff, then it's really a great book, yeah. But it's very rigorous. It's full of math. So, but this is the other side to look at it. So Zelizky's perspective is of computer vision, like in a broader sense. Okay, let's do some learning here. Let's do some image processing here. So yeah, while this book is indeed centered on the geometric questions. Yes, please. Please? Multiple view. You see, without Google, I'm a total loser. So multiple view geometry. Thank you. There's another book by Fougerat that goes in that line. Hardly. This is a man, multiple view geometry. We will see. Multiple view geometry. Yes, that was right. Thank you. Good. So the primary book for this lecture is this one here. Yeah. Okay. Good. So let's do some introduction. I'm just going to talk a little bit about the objectives of computer vision and some real world applications of computer vision, which are nowadays, I mean, they're just pervasive. So he's a very renowned researcher. It's Jitendra Malik from Berkeley, one of the really big computer vision guys. And he, a couple of years ago, he aimed at coining this notion of the three R's of computer vision. The classic problems of computer vision are reconstruction, recognition, and reorganization. So he was missing an R here. So organization became reorganization. And then what he was aiming at was to say, okay, and we need to, as these methods now become, the individual methods become now better and better, we have to look at the interaction between these methods and how they converge. We'll come to this later, so don't worry a bit about it now. But reconstruction, recognition, and reorganization. So what can we reconstruct or recognize or so in real life? So here's a list. It's actually pretty small font. Anyway, so let's just look at a couple of examples. Yeah, if we think of an auto login without a password, yeah, by just looking at the biometrics of the face, then it's essentially face recognition. It's a classical computer vision task. If we think in general, if we think of smartphone cameras, then we have a million applications of computer vision. I think that is something that really put computer vision, smartphones really brought computer vision like to the mass market probably. So let's think of QR codes, some things like the image stitching, the artificial image blur, like depth of field that is introduced by modern cameras, all types of face detection, the Snapchat filters, and so on and so on. Okay, if we think of the web, yeah, the image search, related images, lists of related images, things like that, these are typical retrieval problems in computer vision. Then virtual reality or augmented reality, this is VR, AR, is now a big topic with all the virtual reality glasses that are available. Think of the HoloLens or the ATG Vive, HTC Vive, that enable now many augmented reality applications. Okay, the body tracking of the Xbox made a big splash when it was first proposed. There are applications in medical imaging as well. Thinking of a segmentation of pathologies, for example. And then, of course, the whole industry branch, so the robotics. And a big topic also, although not very spectacular, is optical inspection. So it's something where a lot of companies make a lot of money with. And then, of course, yeah, okay, surveillance, da 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 da. Okay. Transportation, if you think of autonomous driving, for example, I mean, that's maybe the most spectacular example, but also just driver assistance is an example of a very complex computer vision system. And then, of course, all types of entertainment that are done with the help of computer vision methods. like visual effects in movies, virtual sports replay is a very nice example that we will look at later also, and other things. Okay, so this is a long list, so let me show just a couple of images then later. So here's one very old problem. It's optical character recognition, for example, to read license plates. For example, when it costs money to use a highway, now you could have automated systems that do the billing based on readings of license plates. We also have a project right now on license, or I'm loosely participating in a project on license plate reading from severely degraded images. So when the police tries to catch someone, they're looking at this, like this video, and it really, it doesn't show much, just a bunch of pixels. And then they are wondering, like, yeah, can we somehow narrow the search down, no? On the license plate, no? Such that we say, maybe, yeah, maybe the first and last position or so, maybe we can make a guess there and somehow narrow it down, what car it was that drove there. So these are modern applications also of license plate readers. Then face detection, yeah, comes with smartphones everywhere. For example, the Snapchat face swap thing. This is a case where it kind of works. Here are two failure cases. Like this is a particularly nice example, I think, because it really shows that, well, okay, these machine vision algorithms, they have a certain strategy to proceed, but it's not necessarily an actual face that they detect. Yeah, smile detection to have, like, I mean, that's really from the field of entertainment. Here's another nice application or interesting application, because it's such an open-ended problem. This is that, so here in the background, it's probably not well readable, but there's a sign that you don't need to, like, you can do the checkout in the supermarket just by walking out, because like all you put in your bag and so on, they are like tracking underways. So you don't need to make this explicit payment, no? They just deduct it from your bank account. whether this is desirable or not, it's a tough vision problem. because you really, I mean, you really have such a high variability in the data to look at. Yeah, here, okay, of course you can put up cameras everywhere and then try to see what people are grabbing from the shelves. But still, if we look here at a close up, it's a tough problem, because we have, for example, motion blur, so we don't have a clear spot to look at things. So it's kind of a tough problem. Yeah, biometrics. Here's an example of an Afghan woman re-identified from high-resolution photographs by looking at the iris. And there's a story to it, which you can look at. Then, yeah, passwordless logins. And the question, okay, like, how can we actually make this secure? Because if we take a printout of a face and put it in front of the camera, then this is an easy way to spoof such a face recognition system, typically. And like, here's, for example, a proposed solution, like a proposed computer vision solution that uses a depth sensor to capture a 3D image instead of a 2D image, and then to be able to tell apart, okay, that has the shape, like this has the 3D geometry of a face instead of the 3D geometry of a printout. Okay, object recognition. 3D from images, that's the reconstruction that Jitendra Malik mentioned. So for example, you have a camera moving around an object, and then you try to reconstruct in 3D that object based on the camera readings. Yeah, that is a topic that has been a topic for a while already, has a lot of applications. For example, people in humanities, they would like to record all their old temples. That has particularly in Japan been a big topic for a number of years already, probably For one reason, certainly, because the temples in Japan are built out of wood, so they have a shorter lifespan than if built out of stone or so. And the other thing is, of course, it's a technologically quite advanced country, so they have been dealing with this like 3D reconstruction for cultural preservation for quite a while already. But here's another example, what is cited here, this building Rome in a day. That was a paper that got quite a bit of attention because it had a relatively unconstrained scenario. So they were fetching photographs from the internet of Rome or some landmark buildings in Rome, respectively, and sort of automatically figured out the alignment from where these pictures were taken and then used to reconstruct these buildings. And the computations were parallelized nicely such that they could solve this task within a day in a massive computer cloud. And then I think one or two years later, another paper came out that had the title Building Rome on a Cloudless Day. So the novelty there was essentially that they said, okay, we have a couple of speed ups such that we can get away with a big array of GPUs instead of a whole compute cluster. Okay, so that's like how things progress, and they currently progress really fast. Yeah, human shape capture. Here's an example of digitizing former President Obama. What's also quite instructive is if you look, you can see the experimental setup. So we have light sources from different positions, and you don't necessarily have them all switched on at the same time. Yeah, it may also make sense that you say, okay, I have one on, then the other on, in order to deduce the surface shape of the surface from the change in the reflectance brightness. Yeah, I didn't look at the details of this acquisition scheme. I'm just saying that there are certain possibilities. Okay, and then there's the reconstructed geometry. And here with the surface texture and color, so so-called albedo, to actually make a full 3D scan of Obama. Okay, yeah, and then you can do all kinds of stuff with it, like print it again or so. Yeah, okay, same thing, of course, in entertainment, né, here from the Star Wars movie, sort of, if actors already passed away, you can virtually recreate them with essentially the same set of tools here from the Planet of Apes. I'm just jumping because it's these are just different applications, but in terms of tools and techniques, it's not so much different. Or here's another example in gaming. No? You have sensors like here, the Kinect sensor that measures and estimates a combination of both the depth in a scene and then uses that in order to perceive the motion of the player in the game. Okay, here's a nice example from sports. There's an even nicer example, but we will not talk about it today. Here's a nice example because it looks so easy. And that is from American football. So in American football, it's always important to make a certain progress within a certain set of moves. Yeah. And this progress means like you need to make 10 yards. Yeah. And they mark the goal in television with a yellow line. And this yellow line is superimposed on the image. So it's not on the actual playing field, but depending on the situation, they put it in different locations. So since this is a just broadcast as part of regular sports transmissions. It has to be like super robust. It has to just work. No? And here's a nice article that outlines the effort that has to be taken. Essentially, it boils down to cameras that very accurately know where they are in the world and where they are looking at, such that you know, okay, the, I don't know what this is, let's say 54-yard line or something is here. No? And then that also have color maps included such that they know, okay, players are blue, so I'm not drawing lines over blue stuff. Grass is mostly green today. It could be different on a snowy day or something like this, no? But today the ground is green. And so we only draw over green. And then there are still a couple of human operators checking that things don't fail. No? And then it's broadcast with a slight delay. So not super live, but a couple of frames delay such that all the processing can be done and integrated on the television screen. Okay, yeah, medical imaging, like image-guided surgery, for example, 3D imaging. Yeah, we also have here at Erlangen a large branch working in medical image processing. That is what Andreas Meyer is mostly doing at the Pattern Recognition Lab in collaboration with Siemens. A lot of this done in collaboration with Siemens and with the hospital. Yeah, then of course, autonomous driving. here we have an example of Uber cars. They recently had not so great press because of a lethal accident. But I actually didn't really follow up. So was it now the fault of the driver or wasn't it? Did you read about this? It's not clear yet. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so someone was stepping out, apparently at night and so on, no? On the road, and then was hit by a vehicle, by Uber. And then, so at first it was like, yeah, okay, so these autonomous driving cars, they are just like a threat or so, so let's ground them for a while. And then, yeah, a couple of other news items came like, yeah, okay, maybe this autonomous driving system was not activated at all at the time, or maybe it was just not possible to see that person because it was too dark. Yeah, I think we have to see how things turn out there. Nevertheless, I mean, autonomous driving, for example, in California, there are Google cars are just driving on the roads, no? So it's something that is really coming. And I think it's an example that also shows very nicely this incredible progress in computer vision, because autonomous driving started, it started maybe a long time ago, but 10 years ago, there was the so-called DARPA Grand Challenge, and it was about it was a challenge that cars should autonomously drive through the desert of Nevada to a predefined goal. And the winner gets like $1 million or something. So not really much compared to the effort that it takes to assemble a team, pay the people and so on. No? But of course, it was a very prestigious competition. And it was really difficult. So it was a very ambitious goal. And a lot of people were skeptical that it can be reached at all. But it had some success and it really spurred research in that field. And then afterwards, the DARPA Urban Challenge was published. I think that was 2007 or 2008. So the Grand Challenge is more than 10 years ago. It should be like 12 years or so. Okay, the Urban Challenge was, yeah, we want cars to drive like on a free road and everything, but through a city. And then again, people were like, yeah, are you crazy or what? Like in a city, really? No? And okay, a number of cars crashed, but still it, I mean, that's just 10 years ago. No? And now like on a daily basis, these cars do drive autonomously through traffic situations, like not empty cities or deserts or something. No? So it's really tremendous. Okay, here's a close-up of the sensor array. Yeah, so, okay, the contrast is really bad, but we have a lot of cameras here monitoring the environment. Google Street View, yeah, okay, and then stitched together like whole cities, essentially, no? So this is type of like large scale image data processing, like what the big companies, internet companies are doing. Okay, then industrial robots like here for assembling vehicles. That's a very common application. Then of course. For the whole space program, Vision plays a role, like for this example, for the Mars rover. Mobile robots, we also have in Erlangen a soccer team, but it's a small size soccer team playing robot soccer. But that's not really a mobile system because the small size robots don't have own vision units. There's a camera on top of the play field observing the field, and the robots are just playing. But with these like robot dogs, indeed, like every player has his own camera and makes his own like onboard his own decisions. So in that sense, this robotic league, it's more like an ensemble of autonomous vision units. Okay, then, yeah, augmented reality, virtual reality. Okay, yeah, so let's quickly come back to Malik's statement of the three R's. So the future progress in the classic problems of computational vision, so that's more or less now the outlook. Reconstruction, recognition, reorganization requires us to study the interaction among these progresses. So his assumption or his hypothesis is that these fields are kind of converging a little bit, and that this is what vision is dealing with, like the next couple of years. Okay, so I already talked a little bit about geometry, a little bit about other things. So let me try on this slide to further maybe try to clarify a little bit how computer vision relates to other fields. So particularly to computer graphics, it's interesting. So in both cases, for computer vision and computer graphics, we have a model of the world. In computer vision, we're trying to infer that model from images, video, some other sensor data. In computer graphics, we sort of use a model to generate digital reproductions of the world, which could again be images, videos, some other stuff. And at the same time, if we have such a model, we can also reply to specific questions that might be asked. Like if you think of your smartphone, yeah, face recognition on a smartphone, the question would be, is this a face that is there in the scene? No? And then we have a model, like what we say is a face, no? And if it is found, we could say yes, something like this. Okay, so there's certainly a very close relationship between computer vision and computer graphics. If we think of the tools that are used in computer vision, geometry is really a stellar example, I'd say. So the mathematically most rigorous component of computer vision and computer graphics, at least in my opinion. So this part of the slides is not copied from somewhere else. There's another view to computer vision to say like, yeah, you know, like that's just visual machine learning applied to visual data. That now refers to a completely different corner. If you think of the recognition task, yeah, like character recognition, something like this, it just involves a massive amount of machine learning. Yeah? And then you could say like, yeah, okay, so machine learning, this is statistics, it's a clear mathematical problem description, and then it's just an application, like computer vision is just an application of statistics, no? Maybe to get more research funding or something like this. No? Okay. I think there's another relationship, maybe currently not so super dominant, but in a latent way also always there, a relationship to physics. Because when you build these models, you oftentimes put some physics-based priors in your models, no? Something, some assumptions about the physical world that you are observing. Yeah. Now the interesting thing is when computer vision people put on their posters or whatever, like, yeah, I have a physics-based model here at a conference or so, and then a true physicist comes, then they always start to fight because the true physicist says like, yeah, okay, you know, like this is not physics, I'm sorry. No, this is just like some assumption of Gaussian noise or so, which does not occur in the real physical world. No, so, and that's quite interesting because one additional requirement in computer vision, as opposed to pure physics, is that the models that we use are tractable. Yeah, we need to, I mean, we don't have the models in order to just describe the world, but we want to compute something with it. Yeah, like our actual goal is something else than ending up with the model. So we oftentimes compromise with the model accuracy in order to make the problem as a whole tractable. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, we can sharpen this in the course of the summer. Good. So that's it with the introduction. We have another half an hour left. So So let me start to talk a little bit about images. We will certainly not be able to talk about all this stuff today, but maybe half of it or so. So this is about light and color. So the question, what is an image? What is color? How is color represented? Because these are the very fundamental atoms essentially of the data we're dealing with. So what is an image? Let's start very basic. I mean, we can say, let's just draw some numbers in an array of 256 times 256 and say, okay, shouldn't this be an image or so? No? If we randomly draw these numbers, we would say like, yeah, technically it's probably an image, right? But perceptually it's not very helpful. And we can also answer other specific questions, like for example, how many different images are there? Yeah, and then we can say, well, if you have 256 times 256 pixels, each pixel has an 8-bit grayscale value, so between black, 0 is black, no? 255 is white. So this means we have 256 256 times 256 is 65,000 something, yeah, 2 to the 16, yeah. So we have it's the same like a number with 256 values that has 65,000 digits, yeah, okay. And this is a huge number, so there's no way to fit this into memory, yeah. So we cannot, like, any attempt to enumerate all images or so is just doesn't make any sense, yeah. Okay, and this is the starting point for the computer vision people to say, like, yeah, okay, so we cannot, like, we have always to resort to some form of estimation, some form of prediction, because we're trying to make sense of an extremely high dimensional space. So it doesn't make sense to enumerate anything or so. Yeah, that's just a stupid idea. No? But on the other hand, we just saw that image that was like pure noise. Yeah. So it's not the case that each of these possible images makes sense. Yeah. Actually, if we think about quantities, probably most of these images don't make sense. Yeah. And a little bit more technically expressed, so we only need to deal with a subspace of natural images. Yeah. So it's a small manifold, small compared to this behemoth of a number. Yeah. Okay. And then, of course, what we are trying to do is to derive also a low-dimensional model that we can explain. Okay, very briefly, okay, a point in an image is called a pixel. Certainly you know this, or probably you know this. We address it with X and Y, and it has a certain intensity, for example, 138. And particularly people who come a little bit more from the direction of electrical engineering spend a lot of thought of, okay, what actually is an image? Yeah, what is a pixel? No? And we can say it's a signal, no? And that is also, like, we have a relationship here to the field of signal processing, actually. So it means we have a function depending on some variable with physical meaning. And the actual image is a sampled version of that function, or a sampling of that function. If we have a 2D image, then we have two variables, the X and Y coordinates, where we decide to sample. If we have a 3D image, what could that be? It could, for example, be a video. So then the third dimension is time. It could also be a true 3D measurement if you think, for example, of depth sensors, or, yeah, okay, depth sensors. Okay, and the brightness is the value of the function for visible light. Okay, but of course, I mean, we're dealing very often with light, but don't feel restricted to that. It could also be temperature, pressure, depth, any other physical quantity in principle. Okay, so here are some examples, yeah? Okay, so this is just a picture as we know it, a photograph. This is also essentially a photograph, but it's done in not in the visible spectrum, but in the infrared spectrum. So you would say it's a thermal image. But other than that, just a picture. Yeah? This actually is, well, you can't see anything probably, but it's an ultrasound. It's an ultrasound image. Yeah? So it's a completely different domain that is visualized here with bright and dark values. And this is a reconstruction of a brain from a magnetic resonance image. So it's also a completely different domain. So it doesn't necessarily need to be visible light. Good. So how does sampling work? So we can say this function here represents the real world, a continuous function, yeah? And then we sample that function at discrete points, and these are the measurements that we denote as pixels eventually. Here plotted in 1D, we can also do this in 2D, of course. And yeah, sampling in 2D takes a function, returns a matrix. So we just extend our smooth functions in two dimensions. And the brightness is the height. And then we have discrete sample points. And that is actually what we colloquially understand as an image. Yeah. So we have a matrix, X and Y coordinates of brightness values. Okay, so here's a 3D plot of a grayscale digital image, and here is a better understandable version. So it's a satellite image in our usual representation. Okay. So more in detail, let's have a look at the models. So so we assume we have a light source, some illumination source. Then we have a scene element. We have an angle of incidence here. And it reflects possibly in all directions, but we cannot really tell. We can only tell, okay, so it reflects something towards our imaging system, towards our lens, our sensor. And then there is in that imaging system an image plane in one way or another. And there this object is projected onto. Yeah. So we will have to think a little bit about projection when we are going to reason about the position, the 3D position of elements in a scene. Yeah. Okay. But let's not talk about this now. For the moment, we just have that image plane, and we sample at discrete locations, and then and this gives us an output image that has that consists of a number of pixels. Okay. And then there's the notion of resolution. Maybe we can skip this for now. But there's geometric resolution, spatial resolution, and there's also radiometric resolution that is related to quantization. So how fine do we sample the brightness values in the image? Do we do an equidistant sampling here, or maybe a logarithmic sampling? And here we see an example for radiometric quantization. So here's an image where we use 256 grayscale values per pixel, and then it's gradually decreased. And the most extreme case is maybe if we just look at black and or white. Yeah, a pixel can be either black or white, and we see we have a very coarse radiometric resolution then here in this case. Okay, so when we characterize an imaging system, then resolution certainly plays an important role. That can be spatial, it can be radiometric, and it also depends beyond spatial resolution what do we have interactions between pixels. So I could have a system with a very high spatial resolution. Let's look back here. With a high spatial resolution, but still a blurred image, because I have a lot of crosstalk between pixels for different reasons, can be optical reasons, can be electronics reasons, or so. Okay. Good. So let's talk about color. So what is color? The usual way to split up color in a camera is to say, okay, I have a red channel, a green channel, and a blue channel, and I mix those three channels together to get all the colors that I want or I need. Yeah. So for example, input image here, and then when you download the slides, you can maybe see that better, but there are differences like for red, green, and blue structures in these three color channels. Okay, so that means now in MATLAB notation, but it's not much different in any other programming language. If we say a 2D image is one matrix, then if we have red, green, and blue, it means we have three of those matrices. And for convenience, we can just say, okay, let's arrange them behind each other, in a block behind each other. So that means we have a cube with three dimensions to address, yeah? X, Y, and then red, green, blue, for example. In OpenCV, it's the same thing, yeah? You have a matrix that is a VEC3B, a vector of 3 bytes. These are the three color channels. And then you have in square brackets, first the Y coordinate, then the X coordinate, and then the number of the color channel. And you're done. Okay. Good. So, but what is color? And now a little bit about the human eye, so human vision. You can say the human eye is a camera. We have an iris, we have a pupil, and so the pupil, the role of the pupil is to have an aperture that, and the size of that aperture is controlled by the iris. And we're wondering, okay, so where's the sensor? The sensor are the photoreceptive cells on the background of the eye. And how is light perceived? So there are ones, the cones, they perceive color, and the so-called rods, they are sensitive to brightness changes. And it turns out that the activity of those two, the cones and the rods, is not always the same. But in situations where we have bright scenes, then the cones dominate. So we have good color vision. If the scene becomes darker and darker, then the rods take over. So we don't see colors anymore in very dark scenes, but we only perceive brightness differences. Okay, and what do we see at all? I mean, on a physical level. If we look at the electromagnetic spectrum, then we have gamma rays, X-rays. Okay, this is all invisible and much too much energy. Ultraviolet rays, and then there's the visible spectrum, and we leave it again, so for the infrared, microwave, and radio wave domain. Yeah, and the visible spectrum, it's fairly narrow, with a wavelet range between 400 and, okay, I would have gone to 800 or so, but anyways, nanometer wavelength, yeah? Okay. Good. Now, if we look at the sensitivity of the cones a little bit closer, then we again have here on the x-axis the wavelengths between 400, 650 nanometers approximately. And it turns out we also kind of have sensitivity to blue, green, and red. Yeah. So in that sense, It's not so super different from what we have seen with this image representation in a red, green, and blue channel. Yeah, there's a difference though if we look at the distance between these curves. Yeah, so it's not exactly identically distributed or anything, but here we have a high correlation between those two color channels, if you like, while this one here is pretty much alone. Yeah, which makes biologically makes sense, because the interesting colors are green like plants or so, and red like blood. No, so we need to put a little bit more effort in there, or a little bit more energy in there, to differentiate them, as opposed to different shades of blue. Okay. Yeah, we are looking at these spectral plots already for a while, but what do they actually say? So so what we see here is kind of a distribution, yeah, of different colors. So we have the full like rainbow here, no? Blue over green to red, and we can describe the color distribution of a patch by its spectrum of incident light. So that denotes the number of photons per time unit at each wavelength incident. And that is actually what a multispectral camera measures, records. Okay. So here are some examples for different light sources. The special thing about a laser is that it has a very narrow spectrum. So it only emits light at one wavelength, essentially. Then if you look at a gallium phosphide crystal, it's still relatively narrow, but much wider than a laser. And then like the normal light sources that we have, like an old school light bulb, which is probably, I think it's not allowed anymore to sell them. But a tungsten light bulb, in German Wolfram Lampe, has a broad spectrum that to a large portion consists of these reddish colors, yeah, which is, so the light looks more yellowish than like this cozy light at home, no? That's this tungsten light bulb color distribution, no? Normal daylight is a little bit differently distributed. Now what the hell is normal daylight? What is normal daylight? Sorry? It's the visible spectrum, yeah? Sunlight, yeah. We're talking about sunlight, certainly. But it turns out normal daylight is a pretty arbitrary definition, because depending on where you are on Earth, like how much atmosphere the light has to cross, the spectrum changes. So let's not go too much into this, but different forms of daylight have been normed. Like there's D65, that's probably the normalest normal daylight. It's like a middle European sky in the summer in whatever. Yeah, okay. And the sun is on top of you or so. Yeah. So there are different definitions of normal daylight, but roughly the spectrum looks like this. Okay, and here's some examples of reflectance spectra. Yeah. And you see the shape of these spectra, generally speaking, correlates with the color that we perceive of these objects. So far, so good. So everything makes sense. Yeah. Tomatoes are red, bananas are yellow. Ah, okay. But here comes the first interesting case. So we have the blueberries here, and we have the grapes here. You could say, okay, they're all like purple, right? Or bluish or so. The interesting thing is that the spectra looks quite different, yeah? But still, if we look at the colors of these two, they are not that far apart, yeah? Nevertheless, if we think back that we only have the sensitivity for the three cones, then it makes sense that there might be some ambiguities in the spectrum that eventually integrate up to a very similar color impression. Good. Yeah, here's an interesting particularity. It's called tetrachromatism. it's not really important for this class, but I think it's an interesting thing. So quite some animals can actually see four colors. They have another active cone in the ultraviolet light, and some humans also have it, particularly females. But the problem is that the brain is typically not able to actively use that information, because the people who teach you what colors are, they typically see three colors. So they tell you, okay, this is red, and this is also red, and this is blue, and this is also blue. So your brain then somehow does not, like, it doesn't learn to distinguish that. So it's somewhat not so useful fourth cone. Nevertheless, it's interesting. Okay, yeah, but here's an example how bees see their four colors. So where we just see a yellow flower, no, these are indeed two different colors through the eyes of a bee, and like clearly marking the landing spot here. Okay, yeah. So here's another notion. These are metamers. I already mentioned this with the example of the grapes and the blueberries. So in principle, we can have two different distributions that add up to the same red, green, and blue values, although the underlying distributions are different. And this is called a metamer. Yeah, it's just a term that comes up every now and then it's good to know it. Okay, so last two slides or so. So we looked into what is color, and then the question is why are we dealing with all this physiological stuff? And the reason for that is that like one implicit goal that we always have when we talk about machine vision is to sort of mimic our human perception. Yeah. So in that sense, also when the cameras have sensors for red, green, and blue, what they are doing is they are mimicking our vision system. And also with the algorithms, our goal is essentially to obtain a good performance with respect to tasks where we ourselves are good at, yeah, like autonomous driving. Yeah. Oh, you should have seen that person, or you shouldn't have seen that person. That's it's a very relative statement, no? So I could see that person, so you should have seen it as well. Something like this, no? But maybe if we would have had like an infrared sensor, we would have seen all persons, like even behind walls and stuff, yeah? But that's not up to debate, no? So there's always like an implicit assumption, or very often, that these systems operate the way like we humans operate. And that is also the reason why typically we start off with the human vision. Okay, so, right. So we don't care necessarily about human vision, but we are operating in the human world. Okay, so good. So there follow a couple of more slides on the representation of colors, different representation of colors in like mathematical representations of color. We will talk about this next time. Now, here's something which I forgot at the beginning of the lecture. Next time will not be next week, because both Mark Stamminger and me are out of town. I'm sorry. So next time will be in 2 weeks. We will not have many such exceptions. I think this will be the only exception. But it happens at the beginning of the semester. This is a little bit unfortunate. Yeah. But let me just double check dates. So today is the 9th. The 16th, we both are traveling. So on 23rd, so next week, no lecture, but there will be exercises. Yeah. Now, the question is, how do we communicate how we deal with the exercises? For the time being, I would ask all of you to enroll in StudOn. There's when you look in StudOn at the computer graphics. The computer graphics lab, INF 9, graphische Datenverarbeitung. And then scroll down. You see here, computer vision 2018. So this is the class you're looking for. And then enroll to the class there. So why is that? Because then, first of all, we have a more accurate count. I think it's like 64 or so, but I'm not 100% sure. The second thing is we can send you an email. I mean, we can easily send you an email then, and tell you about the outcome. So I do promise you that we will make a serious attempt to accommodate all, like find a solution that all you guys can participate. Yeah. Given the constraints that we have. Okay. But we will let you know, within this week, about the result. Yeah. So what if we don't find a solution? That's a stupid situation, right? But anyways, if we don't find a solution, I will certainly keep everyone who sent me an email in advance. So take them out of the pool, and then I'll just randomly draw from those people who did not send me an email until we are full, we will certainly be able to do 35 people, 40, no? But it still means I have to say bye to 20. That would be unfortunate, no? I hope this doesn't happen. I'm just announcing the rules in advance such that it's clear how things happen if they happen, okay? Okay, good. Any last questions to this? Okay, then thank you.